I'm so sorry, that just suddenly hit me totally by surprise. A sudden tickle in my throat, and I couldn't get past it. Let me start again, okay? In 2007, the Supreme Court ruled that race alone could no longer be used as a criterion for assigning students to public schools, a decision that changed the approach to desegregation that came after the court's Brown versus Board of Education ruling. Education journalist Sarah Garland looks at the origins of the 2007 Supreme Court case, which was originally filed in Louisville, Kentucky, one of the most integrated school systems in the country. Her book, Divided We Fail, the story of an African-American community that ended the era of school desegregation, looks at race, education, and the history of desegregation in one community and in the country as a whole. It's published by Beacon, and I'm very pleased that it brings Sarah Garland back to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
You grew up in Louisville. Is that what attracted you to the story?
Yes. I grew up and went to public schools there for 12 years. So when I heard about the case, I was very interested, partly because I had gone to the school in the inner city. I was bused downtown, but had spent most of my school days in classrooms with only white kids. So I wanted to look at that.
And that's because many of those schools, even though they're integrated in terms of student population, are pretty much segregated in terms of the classes?
Exactly. They had gifted and talented programs like we have here in New York City. And so they ended up splitting kids within schools, so you still had segregation inside.
And is that part of the problem that was addressed in this case?
Absolutely. It's one of the reasons that the group of black parents and activists that I met brought the original case. They said this is unfair. Desegregation was supposed to improve the quality of education for our kids. And they're here in the regular classes, not the advanced classes. And they were also upset that a lot of their schools were shut down.
Well, we'll get to that. The story does begin begins with the school involved, Louisville Central High School. That school had been historically segregated, wasn't it? It's the school that Muhammad Ali S. Cassius Clay attended?
That's right. Yes, it was the black school in Louisville for many years.
So how soon after Brown versus Board of Education did Louisville start integrating schools?
1975.
It's still a while.
It's a while, yeah.
And then how did they go about doing that?
They did it in an interesting way. They ended up merging their suburban district with their urban district, which really prevented a lot of the white flight that you saw elsewhere. So that's one of the reasons why they were able to have such an integrated system.
Did it lead to the same kinds of protests and violence that we saw elsewhere?
Yes, absolutely. It was pretty bad for the first year.
When we look at the history of desegregation in this country, it seems like it's usually been the white parents who have been opposed to busing and other efforts to integrate schools more than the black parents. But here it's because the black parents, were they opposed to integration or just opposed to the way what had happened as a result of the integration?
Well, I think you had obviously very different opinions across the community. So you had people who were very supportive. The majority of African-Americans in Louisville when polled were for integration and for busing. But you had a significant minority, about 30% in one poll, that were against it. And the reasons were varied, but they saw this as not helping their kids, and they were frustrated that they didn't have power over their schools anymore.
Well, one of the people involved in this is a man named Ricardo X, and I'm assuming that the last name is inspired by Malcolm X, who opposed integration.
He did, and he had his own frustrating his first day of school was in one of the schools where you had the worst protests in 1975. So he showed up as a brand new teacher and was spit on as he was walking into the classroom for the first day.
Spit on by whom?
By white parents, white students. And so that experience really stayed with him, and he didn't see integration as a good thing.
My guest is Sarah Garland. Her book, Divided We Fail, the story of an African-American community that ended the era of school desegregation. It's published by Beacon. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You write about a girl named Dion who wanted to go to Central High School but was assigned to another school. What was her education like?
She had an excellent experience at first in her first elementary school, but she was sent afterwards to a middle school that was in a white working class neighborhood. She really didn't get the kind of education. And that's another thing that happened, is that a lot of the poorest black students were sent to mix in schools with the poorest white students. So you still had issues of resources and poverty mixing together and making it difficult for the schools.
So how did her education compare with her mother Gwen's experience in the segregated schools of the 60s?
Well, Gwen remembered having a very good experience, and I think it's interesting to talk to people. Most of the people I talked to really did not support segregation, saw it as a very, you know, detrimental experience. But at the same time, there were good things about their schools that they remembered and that they wished had been maintained, including the caring of the teachers, a connection to the community, and they really missed that.
Was there integration in housing and the overall Louisville community as well as in the schools?
Well, that was one of the other issues, is that didn't really happen after desegregation. I think there was a hope that as children mixed within schools, that parents would be influenced. It didn't matter where you lived. Your kids were still going to go to a school that was integrated, that maybe people would move and integrate their you know, residentially. And that really didn't happen. It's pretty much the same way it was 30 years ago.
Kentucky is a border state, isn't it?
Yes.
So it's not the same as being in the Deep South, but were the attitudes pretty much the same as the Deep South?
It's interesting. In Louisville, people, I think, historically have liked to think of themselves a more moderate place, but you definitely had very virulent racist reactions to busing and to integration that were just as bad as Alabama or Mississippi.
And were the reaction to the Brown versus Board of Ed, was that just as virulent in Louisville or in Kentucky in general?
It was interesting because they started an integration program there fairly early on. It was very token, so it allowed white parents who didn't want their kids to go to school with black kids to pull their kids out and send them where they wanted to. So people weren't that mad because it didn't really affect them.
And Omer Carmichael, the Louisville schools superintendent, was praised by President Eisenhower in 1956. He was invited to the White House. What had he done? What was his integration strategy?
Well, he was one of the first superintendents, and Louisville was one of the first places to say, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to integrate the schools. And what was interesting is that, you know, he took that step, and yet it was so token. You had very few black students and white students actually mixing together. You had just a handful in one school and a handful in the other. So really, it didn't make a big difference, but at least, you know, Eisenhower could say, see, Louisville's doing something.
When did full-scale busing start in Louisville?
It was in the 70s, which was the same in a lot of places. It came after a Supreme Court case in the late 60s, and it was just a year after Boston started.
With Boston being a northern city where there was violence as a result of busing. And busing became an issue, and New York became an issue all over the country. What were the complaints in Louisville about busing?
It was very similar. The people didn't want to send their kids on a bus for a long period of time.
And we're talking about white and black parents.
Both. There was complaints on both sides. You saw support for busing fall away among a lot of black families because their kids had to be bused for 10 years, whereas white kids usually had to be bused for 2 years. For example, I could have stayed at my downtown elementary school for 2 years and then gone back to the suburbs if I'd wanted to. I ended up staying much longer. But for black children, they were forced to be bused for 10 years out of their 12 years in the schools.
And didn't busing programs lead to school closings?
Absolutely. You had all over the South, you had schools closed down in downtown areas. There's a case in North Carolina where there was two schools, a white high school and a black high school, and the black school was closed down in order to integrate the white high school. And you had Black families and communities who felt very frustrated that they had put so many resources, they had identities, especially with high schools. They really identified with these schools, and they were special places. To have them shut down was extremely frustrating.
So parents who had good feelings about Central High now saw their kids being shipped somewhere else. And was Central High also threatened with being closed?
Several times. It was talked about a lot. It never happened. It's still open. But it came up very often as they were trying to figure out how to draw white students down to this high school downtown and having a hard time doing that.
Because the school, the buildings were inferior as a result of segregation?
It got a new building right before 1954. That happened also often. Black schools got a brand new building, brand new facilities right before the Brown v. Board decision came down. So the facilities were fine, but there was still that identifier that this is a black school and white parents didn't want to send their kids there.
Did we see a lot more white families sending their kids to private schools as we did in other parts of the South?
There was some of that, but not to the same degree. There was definitely a rise in private school enrollments, but they fell.
Now, we mentioned Ricardo X. When he came to the school as a teacher, was he in support of desegregating the schools?
I don't think he saw a problem with it. The other interesting point of view, I think, from Mr. X, as I always think of him as a teacher, he really wanted his students. He saw his role as holding up his students, the African American students, and really supporting them and helping them find their identity. And he thought that was an important role for him, not just helping them get good grades on tests.
Well, one of the stated goals of desegregating schools is to close the achievement gap between white and black students. Did that happen in Louisville?
It did. It happened across the country. There's studies showing that during the 70s and 80s, which is when you really had busing in full force, that the achievement gap closed at the most rapid rate that it ever has. It's not just desegregation that was a cause of that, but it was definitely a factor.
Did it also improve the education for white students?
There's been research, and most of the research finds that there wasn't a change, so that white students weren't harmed by desegregation. You didn't see, falling graduation rates or falling test scores, for example. The achievement gap didn't close completely, so desegregation wasn't enough.
But as you point out, many of those white students were in classes that were pretty much all white.
That's right.
There were a few elite black students who would get into those classes.
Right.
Is that because the black kids were starting with a disadvantage, as is often claimed?
I think that's part of it. You also had numbers that showed that there was potentially some overt or institutional racism happening, where black students would score well on the test to get into the gifted and talented class, and then their teacher would advise that they not get in. And this happened much more frequently for black students.
Because they were not emotionally prepared or something like that.
So they didn't have to give the reason.
Ricardo X played an important role in bringing about the lawsuit in 1998. He reached out to an organization called CEASE, C-E-A-S-E. Can you tell us about that group?
They were an interesting group. They were an older group, the older generation, who'd graduated from Central mostly when it was still segregated, and they really had strong ties to the school. They also, there was definitely a connection with black nationalism, and that was really, that was happening in the 90s. People were connected to that, and so that was really what they saw as protecting the black cultural identity in Louisville through the school.
Because in the late 90s, we were hearing a lot about people, African-Americans, who didn't want to live in integrated housing. They just felt that they were more comfortable in a segregated situation, people who were like themselves. And that led, I remember, to 60 Minutes segments and such. It almost was a way of reassuring white people that they didn't have to worry too much about integration.
Yeah, it's a very hard thing to do, to pull together diversity, diverse schools, and make everyone happy.
So what happened when CEASE went looking for a lawyer who would represent them in this case against desegregation at Central High School? Did they have a hard time finding someone who would take the case?
They could not find anyone. They ended up finding a lawyer who didn't have any experience really much in education at all, and some experience with civil rights, and they went with him, and he was an interesting character. He was inexperienced but very enthusiastic.
His name was Teddy Gordon.
Yeah.
How did he make the case that the school's desegregation program at Central High School denied black students their rights?
He actually had a lot of help from the judge, who thought this was an interesting issue and very important to pay attention to. The school district was really in a tough place because in order to keep the program going, they had to say they weren't doing their job in desegregating the school and say they had done a bad job. And it was really one of the first times that a school district was defending its desegregation program. So his case was made easier by the fact that the school district couldn't really make a case against themselves and say, you know, we should really keep this program intact because we haven't done everything that we should be doing.
My guest is Sarah Garland, who's a staff writer at the Hechinger Report. Her book, Divided We Fail, the story of an African-American community that ended the era of school desegregation. It's published by Beacon. There had been a number of court cases on both the state and federal level after Brown versus Board of Education. Did these begin to undermine desegregation efforts across the country? I'm thinking like of Oklahoma City, DeKalb right. County, for example.
Yeah, so there had been a move there. In the 70s, you had the steady push of cases that led to more desegregation. And then in the 80s, you had a bunch of cases that were basically rolling that back. And so you had a case in Oklahoma, out of Georgia. And that really sort of laid the groundwork for this Louisville and the case out of Seattle that ended up going to the court in 2007.
How did the judge rule in this case in the first time it went to court?
Well, in the central case in Louisville, it ended up, the black parents brought this. There was sort of a mixed decision. And the lawyer who they'd found ended up finding some white parents who wanted to keep going and take this all the way up to the Supreme Court. So the judge in Louisville was actually fairly careful about his ruling. He didn't really seem to want to end the desegregation program. He thought that it was doing a fairly good job and it would be very disruptive. But there was a group of white parents that this lawyer was able to find who took it on above his head.
Did this get much media attention at the time?
In Louisville, it did. And around the country, I don't think people were paying attention to this smaller case, which is why it was interesting to me, because you really hadn't seen it. There wasn't any other case like this where it really started with a group of black parents.
Did it change the racial quotas in place at Central High and other schools in Louisville?
And it did in the case of a few schools, the magnet schools, because they were seen as special schools. They couldn't really put a racial quota because there wasn't another school like that kids could go to. But Louisville, unlike many other hundreds of other school districts around the country, basically let their desegregation programs go. Louisville still has a similar program to what it had before, only it uses class and other factors to integrate the schools. But it's almost alone in doing that.
And that has been a concern for a lot of people because class can be as much a factor as race.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So are we saying Louisville has a rather enlightened approach?
It depends on who you talk to. I think that integration is a really important goal. And you see now people in the charter school movement and education reformers talking about how we should really look at increasing diversity in the schools. So Louisville has done it by forcing parents and trying to use choice as one way of making that happen. There's other people now trying to figure out how to make that happen and use choice and make it voluntary, which is also very tricky and very controversial occasionally.
Well, the first case was 1998. Teddy Gordon filed a second case in 2002. What were the circumstances for that case?
In 2002, you had a group of white parents who weren't able to get their kids in the school they wanted to. One of those was a mom who wanted to send her son down the street from her home, and she was instead, he was assigned to a school in the inner city. And she didn't want him to go there. It was a convenience issue. And so he was able to convince her to take this on to the Supreme Court. And it was actually there was not a lot of details in the case. So the justices even commented that they didn't have a lot to go on when they were making their decision.
So it felt like a long shot at the time.
Oh, absolutely. I think it was just the change in the court when you had Kennedy become the swing vote is the only reason it actually was decided the way it was?
Well, there was the 2003 Supreme Court case, Gratz versus Bollinger, which was important in affirmative action and desegregation cases around the country. Did that affect how this case went?
People thought that that case would actually be a precedent that would help the Louisville and Seattle districts who were interested in desegregating the schools, because it said that you could still use race. That, of course, is now being challenged in the Supreme Court right now.
The same, which is made up largely of the same people with a few changes.
Right. And so now the Gratz v. Bollinger and the Grutter v. Bollinger were decided when Sandra Day O'Connor was the swing vote, and now you have Kennedy. So it's all resting on him, and he's a little bit more conservative than she was.
So this case reached the Supreme Court at the same time another one did, a lawsuit that was based in Seattle. How similar was that case?
It was fairly similar. It was, once again, in this case, you had a group of very organized white parents who wanted to change Seattle system, which was a little bit different. It was a tipping point system. So if you had a student who was black and a white waiting for the same school, they would use race as a tipping factor. So it was slightly different than Seattle. In Seattle and Louisville, you had parents who, the white parents were not as enthusiastic. Actually, it was very interesting that it ended up going all the way to the court, because the white parents weren't really as interested in overturning desegregation in the end.
Than the parents in Seattle, Washington, which is
organized.
Considered a much more liberal
Absolutely.
Area.
Absolutely, yeah.
So in the end, the Louisville case kind of was subsumed by the Seattle case.
In some ways it was, and I think what interested me when I went back to do this research is I wasn't really that aware of the Central High School case. I didn't know about it. And when I went down to do reporting and found out that it really originated with this group of black parents, I wanted to find out what happened there. So I think there's lessons to be learned from what went wrong with desegregation and why people who it was supposed to help turned against it.
What argument did Teddy Gordon make before the Supreme Court?
His argument was that schools should be equal. It wasn't necessarily, he's an interesting guy. He's got a lot of heart. He wasn't the most eloquent, but he did his best to convince the justices that any student should be able to get into the school of their choice and they shouldn't be blocked because of their race.
And the Supreme Court handed down its ruling on the Louisville and Seattle cases in June 2007. Can you describe the ruling?
The ruling said that you can use race, but it can be only one of several factors. It can't be race alone that decides school assignment in K-12 schools. And it was debated. It was, it took lawyers. There's a lot of lawyers trying to interpret exactly what it meant and what would be legal to do. You had some school districts that said, you know, it's not worth it. Louisville, they really decided that they wanted to make it worth it and would go ahead and try something with class and race and continue to try to integrate the schools.
There is a notion that the intention of desegregation and busing programs is good and worthy. Did the ruling change those views?
People have seemed to lose interest, I think, partly because it's a very difficult thing to do, because you had so much white flight in and out of cities in the wake of busing, not just because of busing, but you had a real change in the demographics of cities, and so it became very difficult to do that in a lot of places, so it just didn't make sense anymore. So people have tried new ways of improving schools where there isn't a chance of integration. And it's not the only – integration is not a it's not a panacea. It doesn't solve everything.
The subtitle of your book is The Story of an African-American Community That Ended the Era of School Desegregation. Ended it?
I may have spoken too soon because of this movement we are seeing now, where you have education reformers who'd really been, talking about charter schools and primarily minority neighborhoods, and that was their focus.
We have Michelle Rhee coming on our show tomorrow.
You should ask her about this. It's really interesting. I actually got an email from, or a Twitter from Kaya Henderson, who's the current chancellor in D.C., asking me about, we want to talk about doing diversity in our schools. So it's become this topic among education reformers today that it wasn't 10 years ago. So it's very interesting.
Are they looking for ways to get around the ruling?
They're trying to do it voluntarily. So if you you know, one way that you can do this, you can't necessarily, in a charter school, for example, you can't use race per se, but you can use income and you can do recruitment. So there are ways around it.
My guest is Sarah Garland. Her book, Divided We Fail, the story of an African-American community that ended the era of school desegregation. Were people in Louisville generally pleased by the Supreme Court ruling?
I think it was a mixed bag. I think people at the school district and in the school board were happy they didn't have to get rid of their program. I think you had a lot of parents who were still frustrated.
What about the people in CEES?
They weren't really as interested anymore. They'd seen the cases not their own that had been taken out of their hands. A lot of them said, you know, it's not our fight anymore. They took it, you know, we wanted to save Central. So it was really interesting to see them say, you know, that's fine. If we have integrated schools, that's fine with us, but we want to save our school.
Since the Supreme Court ruling was largely based on the Seattle case, did they feel that they had been kind of cut out of the story?
Well, definitely for the black parents, because they weren't a part of that case and hadn't really been consulted about it moving on, they didn't feel like it was their case anymore. It had been taken away from them in some ways.
What's happened to Central High School?
It's still open. It had been had some selective programming. It still does that. I was looking at the numbers and just, you know, numbers with test scores and graduation rates. Those had fallen a little bit since it became they basically took away the quota after the first case. So it became more black quickly. It was about 80% black after being about 40%. And some of that went down, but it's still, you know, it's still a good school.
This year, the Supreme Court will hear arguments for Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin, which challenges the University of Texas affirmative action program. Do you think the case for affirmative action is eroding in this country?
It's been a fight that's been going on for a long time. I think you have universities who feel very strongly that we need some way to make sure we're recruiting a diverse class so that this is really a case about elite universities, so that the people who go on to be in power and influence are racially diverse. But, you know, it's definitely been eroding, I think, and you have a lot of numbers now showing that while some of these elite schools may have some racial diversity, they don't have any economic diversity, very little economic diversity. And so there's a big debate going on about whether socioeconomic diversity shouldn't be something we look at.
I'm curious about this in another way. The Louisville case was based on a group of people. This new case is based on a young woman who feels that all she wanted to do was go to the University of Texas at Austin and couldn't get in because a black student was given preferential treatment. Could this lead to anybody not getting into a school suing and saying, well, you know, I had higher SAT scores than that other kid, and they decided that the other one would get in because she was a member of the chess club?
It's interesting. I think with race, it's a protected under the Constitution. So I think that, you know, hopefully it won't go further than that, and where you have that kind of sort of crazy lawsuits happening. But it was interesting. I did a story where I went to Austin, and I met with a black student who had gotten in with very somewhat similar academic credentials as the woman who's suing, and talked with her about, you know, what would have meant if you hadn't gotten into this school. And, you know, I think there was students there who really felt like affirmative action, they were the beneficiaries, obviously, but without it, they wouldn't have had a chance to get into this school.
And Clarence Thomas says that to some degree diminishes the achievements of black students.
Yeah, I think there's arguments on both sides. It's a very tricky issue. And I think for the students themselves, what they care about is getting a good education. And I think one thing that we can look at is data that show that universities aren't graduating as many minority students. There's an achievement gap there with the graduation rates.
We started our conversation talking about a young student named Dion. What was her high school experience? How did it turn out?
She didn't have a great high school experience. She went to a high school in a white working class neighborhood in Louisville, and just really she'd had a hard time generally with the case and with other personal issues. She didn't enjoy her high school experience at all. She ended up dropping out. She's now in school and doing better, and really working on achieving. But I think her case, the reason she joined this case is because she ended up being, instead of going to Central, she ended up being sent to a school where the majority of the population was poor, working class like herself.
A Stanford University study published late last year showed that large and medium-sized school districts in the South have steadily resegregated over the past few years as a result of that Supreme Court ruling.
That's right. I looked at that study a while back, and you've had school districts, I think there's only a couple hundred or so that are still, large school districts that are still desegregating their schools, and that's gone down significantly. Partly because, you know, courts have lifted the requirements on some school districts. They were mandated to do it, but there's been a huge drop.
Now, you specialize in writing about education. Did your attitude towards school desegregation change over the course of working on this book?
Yes, it did. It became much more nuanced. You know, I went into it. I was a product of busing. I really appreciated the perspective it gave me. You know, I went to an inner city school. I wouldn't have gone to those neighborhoods probably otherwise. But I also think that the problems, the way that white families and students were privileged under desegregation, it really opened my eyes to that and to really understanding those failures and what we might do differently now.
And what might we do differently? Have we really learned much from the successes and failures of busing programs?
Well, I think one of the things that happened is that black parents became so frustrated, and you saw this loss of support among, you know, just regular folks who were sending their kids to school, because you had black teachers who were fired in huge numbers. You had black principals who lost their jobs, schools closed, and people were really frustrated with that outcome. And you see some of those same things happening. There was a huge protest in D.C. last week of families saying, we don't want our schools closed.
Well, forced busing is unlikely to ever be revived, but what are other ways to make schools more diverse racially? Do you think that it can be done any other way?
I think one of the opportunities, and several people are writing about this right now, is that you do see a changing demographics where you have, in New York, you can see it, where you have neighborhoods that are changing and becoming more integrated. You have gentrification, and those people are seeing an opportunity to maybe create more schools. The same thing is happening in the suburbs. Just one of the issues with that is really, you know, creating diverse schools where they stay that way, and that's hard.
And we're seeing that in the all of the arguments over charter schools and magnet schools. So I guess we're not going to resolve it in the next few days. Sarah
No.
Garland's book, Divided We Fail, The Story of an African-American Community That Ended the Era of School Desegregation, is published by Beacon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.